Support Indigenous Media. Do you remember when we reviewed Rumble, the Indians Who Rocked the World on episode 22? Join us for a special one-night showing of this new music documentary by Resolution Pictures at the Frank Banco Alehouse Theater at the Steel Stacks in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania on Tuesday, November 14th at 7:15 p.m. Tickets are $10 at the door. Welcome inside 254. Let's close the office door and start the conversation.
Today's talk around the table is about growth and how to reframe those conversations and rethink how we consider the word growth and what that means in our communities.
Right. So I'm wondering, what if we talked about growth? Because primarily when we think about growth, we think maybe about the economy or maybe about population growth. What if we reframed and started talking about growth in terms of quality over quantity? What would that look like? So what if in all of our industries and workplaces, we started privileging, say, quality of time and how our time is spent, making space and time for thinking through problems, developing sensible solutions, envisioning and implementing practical and reasonable plans instead of squeezing all the tasks in this chaotic frenzy into busier and busier schedules? Aren't we losing quality as a result of this focus on quantity in growth? I did a search on Google Trends. That's a thing, actually.
I had no idea. There you go. Cool.
So in Google Trends, I did a search for the term growth. So Google Trends lets you know what the trends are related to, say, a search term. So I wanted to find out where this term is coming up and in what context. So the top five states in the United States where the search term growth was the most popular in the last 7 days was, number one was Mississippi, then Massachusetts, Virginia, Indiana, and New York. And people searching in those states for the term growth also were searching these topics: human development, so biology, population, rate, so growth rate, and that is an economic concept, population growth and economic growth. And I did the same exact search past 7 days, but for the world, and worldwide, the number one country where the term growth was the most popular in the past 7 days is Zimbabwe, number two Ghana, Jamaica, Uganda, and Nigeria. So four of those nations are on the African continent, and people searching for that term within those nations searched these topics. Human development was again number one. Economic growth was now number two, population, rate, again, an economic concept, and economy. Growth mindset and exponential growth were also in the top five related searches in both the U.S. and the world. So
that's so interesting.
So clearly people who are even searching for the idea of growth are primarily focused on economic and population. And what I wanted us to do is really just complicate the idea of, when we talk about growth, I think we can all agree that's typically where we go. But what if we started talking about it in difference, quality over quantity, and related to maybe time instead of, again, making money?
Well, in our, I think our nation, when we talk about growth, we think about the GDP, which is the gross domestic product. Those numbers come out, and then we have conversations about whether or not the United States, we're conflating United States and United States economy, whether or not the United States is growing at a rate that we should quote unquote be growing. And the GDP measures the sum of the market values or prices of all final goods and services produced in an economy during a period of time. So that is a very economic determiner of growth. Mm-hmm. And there have been a lot of people and organizations that have been saying we cannot assess our growth as a nation solely based on economics.
That's interesting. I didn't realize that.
Yeah.
Can you say more about that? That's cool.
So there have been a lot of groups lately that have been saying, well, if the American economy continues to grow at that rate, first of all, who does that benefit? It's not leveling out economic inequality, but also it's not sustainable for the planet if we can continue to grow in that way, because that means there's a consumption of resources and that the planet doesn't keep producing these things at the same rate that some economists have determined that our GDP needs to, the rate that the GDP is growing at. So there are all kinds of really interesting tanks have suggested or other countries are using. There's the green GDP, which is an index of economic growth that factors in environmental consequences.
That's a thing.
Oh, these are all things. Yeah. So the United States Congress did commission research on such measures. Now,
I'm so impressed. Well, I'm surprised. When did that happen?
2008. Oh. don't be super impressed, because I don't know that anything came of it.
Yeah.
But there's also the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development has studied GDP alternatives. I've read about the Index of Sustainable Economic Welfare that takes in pollution, income distribution, right? So that the GDP is just one number, but doesn't factor in like human well-being. And there are some that actually are, like the Happy Planet Index.
I've heard about that.
Yeah, the Gross National Happiness Measure, the National Well-Being Account, the Genuine Progress Indicator that tries to determine if economic growth has actually improved a country's welfare. This started happening when our GDP kept going up, but then Americans were indicating that they weren't any happier, that they felt stressed out at their jobs, that they felt pushed to their max. That that statistically we work so many hours, and that perhaps structurally the economy is growing, but that individually lots of households weren't feeling that. And there are people who are calling for zero growth, right? Like the GDP, that they're acknowledging that GDP growth is taking away from natural resources, human resources, that the GDP is not enough to measure growth, even though that is the indicator that we often hear about. But that, you know, what you're saying is, are there other things other than economic indicators that we can use to think about growth? And then you brought up population growth too, right? That our planet cannot sustain the level of population growth that continues. And so what does it mean when it's going to be another billion people on a planet that's already so taxed? We forget, I think, sometimes here in like suburban Philadelphia, how taxed the planet is when there are people who are subsistence farmers and agrarian communities, right? You can only ask the planet to do so many things. So how do we think about growth in different sustainable ways and not just economic ways?
And I wanted to bring up an example, and I think you have one too, is within the scope of a job, right? So we had a legislative day, KU APSCoF had a legislative day where we had some legislators to meet with faculty and students to talk about KU, our programs, you know, that sort of thing. And one of our faculty members, who is the director of our Frederick Douglass Institute, she was talking to the legislators about how, because she now has a course release to do this work, she said she can do it better. So the idea of giving a faculty member a single course release out of our 4-4 load in order to do this extra additional work, and then the result is that this person can actually do it better. They can do more for that extra project or that extra event or whatever it is. And that really kind of got me thinking, like, yeah, we should, why don't we talk about the idea of growth with more time, where within the scope of your job, you're given more time to dedicate to this extra additional special task? I think that happened for you too.
Yeah,
right?
It did. So as director of women's and gender studies at Kutztown, that extra job didn't come with any release time. And through the advocacy of many parties, we were able to get one course release per academic year. So what that means is I teach 3 courses instead of 4 in the fall and then 4 courses in the spring. And so I'm in the first semester where I'm in this director role and also have this one course release. And I am so much better for my students.
You know, and it doesn't actually sound like that much time, right? Like out of 8 classes you teach one less. That really gives you enough space and time. Does that?
So what it does.
I feel like people might be hearing that and be like, are you kidding?
But well, because what you need to remember is that the 3 hours that a professor spends in the classroom is not the only time that a professor spends on that course. I would say probably 10-ish hours a week between preparation, grading, in the class. So that gives me space to sit down with students for half an hour instead of trying to rush them within 15 minutes, because I'm in charge of 70 students who have decided that this is a field of study that they think is important. So that's 70 students who are asking me questions, asking for mentorship ideas, thinking about paperwork, thinking about their minor, thinking about graduation, thinking about grad school, thinking about letters of recommendation. The difference that that course release has made in my ability to be a better director and do assessment and talk with other directors and consider name changes and reach out to my advisory board, I am exponentially better at this job because of that time. Exponentially better. Now, I don't know if the university values that work. I hope they do. But I am so, I can grow that program now because I have been given time. Now, on paper, though, I am probably less useful to the university because I'm not teaching as many students, right? So then on paper, if you're doing math, like number of students in a class, who am I teaching? But overall, and I think if you asked at least half of the minors that I've encountered this semester, they would probably all say I'm way more available to them. Mm-hmm. So which kind of growth matters? Right. Is it the human growth that I am able to work and pour myself into these students' lives? Or is it the FTEs, which I don't even know what that word means, but all these universities, they measure growth in different ways. The number of students I'm teaching in a classroom is not the same. So on a spreadsheet, it looks like I'm not contributing as much. But actually, I think I'm contributing way more to my students' lives.
I think you are, too. And I think so is she. Like, that's the
record. Absolutely. Yeah.
The people who have course releases, they're not sitting back and eating bonbons. They're doing additional extra work for a program, in this case, and making that program better for our students.
Right.
And
I really feel like I'm growing humans. And the feedback I'm getting from students, I get so many, like, thank yous, you know, your time has led to this. And I want to do even more of that. I want to grow my students as humans, even if they're not in the classroom with me, which is the only thing that my employer might quantify.
And, you know, for folks out there who are thinking, well, you know, business, that's important, business, because that's all we hear is business model. But guess what? I'm about to put the quash on that one. I found an article from Entrepreneur Magazine from July 2017 that encourages businesses to use quality over quantity when growing their business. And they give some specific examples. For instance, choosing the right hires. So spending more time thinking about who you want, the type of job you're actually getting a new person for, who, you know, really thinking and spending more time on that hiring process to find the right person.
And going beyond like the resume, right? Yeah. Like, and what that does is requires time and it sees your humans as a resource as opposed to like check boxes.
Right.
But that does take more time.
It takes
for people.
More time. And so to allow the time for that. Another example, don't market to everyone, choose an audience and hit them hard. And I have to say, that's what we're doing with our marketing, with our podcast. We have very specific targeted audiences that we're trying to get in front of when we do Facebook ads and other types of marketing. And that's, so again, but that takes time. It's much easier to just throw some generic comment or picture out there and just throw it to the world. Or throw some, you know, a bigger business having an ad campaign, just throwing it out there on any television station, any radio station, it takes a lot more time to think about who am I trying to reach and why, and then can I craft my message to reach that particular niche of an audience, and then how do I make sure it's effective enough to get them to respond, to like our page, to, if it's a business with products, how to encourage them to come and buy the product. I mean, it takes a lot more time to do that, but it's worth it in the end.
So if we use the idea of GDP here for that, mm-hmm. right? Like the idea of having 10,000 quote unquote listeners, but who actually don't listen and see our product as important. So that on GDP wise, that would look really good. Oh, look at all these numbers. Mm-hmm. However, if people aren't listening, it's not sustainable. How do you have a lower number but a higher quality?
Right.
You know, if we even think about the podcast as an example of this, what does it mean to have quality instead of quantity?
And I have another example. Remember MOOCs? Yes, massive online. Yeah. And there was a huge push a few years back to have more MOOCs and more massive online curriculum classes for free. Harvard was doing it, all the big universities. Like, let's have 30,000 people take this class. Well, that didn't really go very, very far and anywhere, because guess what? Having 30,000 people take a class online, there's no quality control there.
Right.
There's no quality control.
And online teaching can be quality.
It can be.
But it needs to be small, and it needs that person needs to have good pedagogy. But this kind of trying to quantify things like education is where we get in a jam, I think. So, how does that factor into when we think about growth? If GDP is the only thing we're doing, we're not even talking about is there an increase in the number of people going to higher ed? There's no other discussion about our growth as a nation other than an economic. And so maybe we're too attached to that. Maybe when I'm not saying the GDP needs to go, but that maybe we need to flesh it out or add something else or make sure we're having conversations about sustainability, human and resource sustainability, when we talk about growth.
Right, because the way it's defined now, it's pretty limiting.
It's super limited. It's solely economic.
I mean, but there's more to our world and more to our social structures, our economic structures, more to our business structures, more to our life structures than just
money.
Right.
I mean, I could work all day and the GDP of my house could double, I guess, but then everybody would be miserable. And I feel like I already work a lot, but the GDP of my house could be always higher, I guess. And that drive to always earn more is not the only thing that should be a driver in our own psyche and in our national psyche.
Yeah. So let's think more purposefully about the idea of growth, and let's try to maybe step away a little bit from the idea of having growth always attached to an economic or a population argument.
I like that idea. Let's expand the conversation instead of just limiting it to one idea.
And what happened then? Well, in Whoville, they say that the Grinch's small heart grew 3 sizes that day.
For a couple of hours out of the whole year, we are the people that we always hoped we would be.
Dearest listeners, we know you enjoy what you're hearing. We work hard to bring you excellent content, and now we're asking for your help. We need to pay our hosting fees for the year, so you can help us be sustainable. A one-time donation of $25, or become a patron at the $8 level, and you will get one of our brand new, hot off the press, logo journals for you to write your resistance thoughts in as we go into 2018. So donate directly to myself or Colleen through Facebook Messenger, or become a patron on our Podbean page for $8 a month and you'll get the journal along with some other swag. We appreciate your generosity in helping us sustain our feminist activist podcast to help you survive the era of Trump. Thanks for keeping us sustainable. Time for Trumpster Fire. Colleen.
Amanda.
Can we please talk about Trump's tweets?
Oh my God. Can we just stop talking about Trump's tweets? Like, could he just stop? Could someone stop it?
General Kelly, where are you? Get on
this.
He's
going to get 280 characters.
I know. So I sort of had the analogy in my head recently that Trump's tweets are like bad weeds. They just keep growing and growing and growing, and nothing stops them or kills them. They're choking off discussion and humanity and reality, and they choke off facts, and they take over the entire garden of legitimate conversation, and they just take over and nothing seems to stop them.
And I know you're gonna find this shocking, but I'm actually kind of glad he tweets.
Oh God.
Because
why?
It's a level of transparency of his lunacy that I
find. You can definitely see the weeds.
Yeah.
But I don't like the weeds.
Well, the I don't like them either, but hey, you know.
You can see them, so
it helps me make claims about him, because all I need to do is open his Twitter feed. Like, yeah. Honestly, when people are on TV, like, blah, 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 and I just have to say, well, Donald Trump was the one who tweeted about that and made everybody upset. Like, nobody was paying attention into the take a knee thing, for example, until, I mean, people were, but not to the level of, like, boycotting the NFL until Donald Trump tweets about it, and then all of a sudden everybody's like, rah! It creates this weird frenzy that I wish I knew how to get off that treadmill, but I also like feel like we're obligated to be on it. So today, here is his Twitter feed today. And honestly, I don't have time to tweet at this level, and I'm just a university professor, so I don't know how this guy has time to like compose tweets. But today is October 5th. We're recording this, and 3 hours ago he tweeted, Rex Tillerson never threatened to resign. This is fake news put out by at NBC News. Low news and reporting standards. No verification from me. Which feels, they didn't need his verification.
It feels like almost every tweet. Well, almost every tweet. Oh, yeah. He labels something with fake. He says that a lot, doesn't he?
Let me show you.
Okay.
So then 4 hours ago, and this connects to the idea of growth. Stock market hits an all caps all time high. Unemployment lowest in 16 years, business and manufacturing enthusiasm at highest level in decades. So first of all, stock market growth does not equate with like income inequality. So that's just people's portfolios who have portfolios getting bigger. So good job, I guess. And also that's been a sustained incline. It's not like that happened when Donald Trump became president. Also the unemployment numbers have been low at the end of Barack Obama's term as well. Then 4 hours ago, he also found time to tweet, why isn't the Senate Intel Committee looking into the fake news networks in capital letters, our country, to see why so much of our news is just made up, hyphen instead of dash. This is one of the things that drives me crazy about him. Then all caps, fake, with an exclamation point. First of all, if he thinks the Senate Intel Committee should be wasting their time looking at like fucking CNN, oh my God. I'm out of my mind. Yeah. So that was this morning.
They have a job
then
to do.
He did retweet somebody who is, you know, congratulated him for making America great again. Ugh. He retweeted Sean Hannity because Sean Hannity was going to tell the truth.
Oh my God.
And also yesterday, wow, so many fake news stories today. No matter what I do or say, they will not write or speak truth. The fake news media is out of control. NBC News is fake news and more dishonest than even CNN. They are a disgrace to good reporting. No wonder their news ratings are way down. Like, this guy cannot get his head out of his ass and start talking about something other than how he is being treated by the media. Like, imagine if Barack Obama had tweeted like this about Donald Trump's birther thing, for example. There is a level of leadership that requires you to rise above some of this.
Yeah.
And the fact that he is in the mire of this instead of leading, like, honest to God, I do not have time to tweet this much.
No, I don't either.
If you go on my Twitter feed, it's like me retweeting stuff, but rarely am I like composing a tweet to like air my grievances about something
or your hurt feelings. I mean, quite frankly, that's the snowflake. We talk about snowflakes. Well, this is the snowflake. His ego is wounded. His pride is wounded. He doesn't like being criticized. He doesn't want people saying bad things about him because he's just so sensitive. And I am so sick of it. I mean, I know you don't mind seeing the weeds, but quite frankly, and this is for you listeners out there, I want to see a digital version of Roundup. So when I see his tweet,
you could just block him.
When I see his tweets come across my and I stopped following him because I was like, I just can't.
You?
This level of anxiety, I can't. I have enough going on. So
I should do this.
I stopped, but
still
people retweet and I still follow the White House, which of course he's fucking in the White House. So I still see the stupidity. So I would like some enterprising digital mastermind out there to develop a digital Roundup app that lets me shoot Roundup, digital Roundup, at every Donald Trump weed that I see on my Twitter feed. So get on it, people.
I'm literally just scrolling Foo's feed, and when we teach about writing, we talk about voice. Like, it's so incredibly obvious when someone else is tweeting on behalf of him and when he's tweeting. Like, it's like two different people. It's so obvious when he is doing it. It's all these like caps and stuff.
It's not like two different people. And then it is.
Right. It's totally two different people because, like, my warmest condolences and sympathies to the victims and families of the terrible Las Vegas shooting, period. God bless you, exclamation point. Like, that is all.
That's not him.
Punctuated correctly.
That's not him.
That's like a level of I know.
He would never say that, nor would he even think it.
But then
he doesn't care about anyone but himself.
He's tweeting because he's like, I'm so proud of our great country, randomly capitalized country. God bless America. Like, I'm like, you just said that yesterday, but you don't even know you said that yesterday.
Because one of his staffers
like,
put it up.
Even if you just look at voice, like, even if you just look at this Twitter feed from a voice perspective, it's fascinating. For me, it's like a car accident.
Digital Roundup.
Digital
Roundup. People, maybe somebody out there, get on it.
And also, I know we're running out of time, but we should also talk about the fact that he is blocking Americans from his Twitter feed. Yes. And are you allowed to do that? Is this censorship not now like a public thing? Like, he blocked Stephen King and all these people. Yeah. Like, Stephen King has every right to see what his president is saying online. So, like, I want to know, is that legal? Are you allowed to block people? I know you're purposely looking away, but also, do you get to block people? What, is this the president or is this him, the real? It's so confusing because it's the real Donald Trump, so we don't even know what that means. And I also love that it has to be the real Donald Trump, and I'm sure there's some capital letters in there too.
He is a reality TV star, and that is how he's running this presidency, as a reality TV star. This is just one giant reality TV show for him. That's all about him. It's all about him. So he's got other people saying, trying to humanize him by putting out things like, we care, you know. No, he doesn't give a shit. He cares about himself. He cares about ratings, and he obviously doesn't give a shit about optics, even though everybody keeps saying he does. He doesn't care. He's just doing Donald Trump. Yeah. And I want a digital roundup. Somebody get on
out
that.
There, get on that.
Make the app for me, please.
That's me spraying it.
Spritz, 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 spritz.
We dedicate ourselves to collective resistance. Resistance to the billionaire mortgage profiteers and gentrifiers. Resistance to the healthcare privateers.
As I have said, and as I believe, the advancement of the full participation of women and girls in every aspect of their societies is the great unfinished business of the 21st century. And not just for women, but for everyone. And not just in faraway countries, but right here in the United States.
Thank you for understanding that sometimes we must put our bodies where our beliefs are. Sometimes pressing send is not enough.
If we want to give all of our children a foundation for their dreams and opportunities worthy of their promise, if we want to give them that sense of limitless possibility, that belief that here in America, there is always something better out there if you're willing to work for it, then we must work like never before.
This episode's fierce woman warrior is
Amy McGrath. I first learned about Amy when I saw her campaign announcement video come across my Twitter feed in early August.
I'm Amy McGrath, and I love our country. I spent 20 years as a U.S. Marine, flew 89 combat missions bombing Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. I was the first woman Marine to fly in an F-18 in combat, and I got to land on aircraft carriers. Now I'm running for Congress against Annie Barr in my home state of Kentucky. He's Mitch McConnell's hand-picked congressman who said he would vote enthusiastically to take health care away from over 250,000 Kentuckians. This is my new mission. To take on a Congress full of career politicians who treat the people of Kentucky like they're disposable. Some are telling me a Democrat can't win that battle in Kentucky, that we can't take back our country for my kids and yours. We'll see about that.
This fierce Marine Lieutenant Colonel, now retired, combat fighter pilot, senior political science instructor, Democrat, and mom decided to run for Congress in Kentucky's 6th District against an incumbent Republican in 2018. Amy represents a level of fierceness that most of us aspire to. She is fearless, smart, calm, confident, reasonable, and speaks her mind freely. I started following her on Twitter the moment her first campaign video ended, and a quick review of her recent Twitter feed shows me her character and readiness for Congress. On October 27th, she shared a story about the opioid crisis and Trump's unwillingness to dedicate more money to this epidemic. She tweeted, quote, "Opioid crisis. No money, no plan, no real interest, and no leadership from this administration." That same week, she also tweeted about the Kentucky GOP governor's efforts to eliminate pensions for state employees, the good work done by NPR, and advancing women in world leadership. Amy McGrath is the definition of a fierce woman warrior, and she deserves our support. Check out her candidate site at amymcgrathforcongress.com. Follow her on Twitter at the @ Amy McGrath KY, and go watch her campaign videos if you want to see what a non-politician with integrity who is outside the DC Beltway sounds like. Let's take a time out for a media minute.
You knew I was going to review Hillary Clinton's What Happened at some point, so here it is. I am really glad she wrote the book with such urgency. That she wrote it so soon after the election gives the reader a sense of the mourning and confusion that she felt, that many of us felt. My favorite chapter is the one in which she finally names how misogyny impacts women candidates in our current political arena. Finally, she said it out loud. I wish she had said it sooner. And a shout out to Susan Bordeaux, whose book I reviewed months ago. I had said that Bordeaux's book helped me understand misogyny in the election. Turns out Bordeaux's book helped Hillary herself understand misogyny in the election. So Hillary and I agree on our reviews of the destruction of Hillary. Readers will come away from What Happened having an answer of what losing an election looks like to Hillary Clinton, but also, and I hate to use this word, but it really humanizes Hillary Clinton, even though I didn't think she needed to be humanized in the first place.
Let's end today's podcast with some activist actions. Do all Indians live in teepees? What is the correct terminology? American Indian, Indian, Native American, Native, How many Indians lived in America before 1492? Do Indians have to pay taxes? Find answers to these questions and so much more at Native Knowledge 360, a new initiative from the Smithsonian's National Museum of the American Indian, or NMAI, to help educators teach about American Indians. But honestly, educators, parents, students, and anyone who is interested can grow your knowledge by digging deep into these free online resources to learn more about Native peoples both past and present. For instance, one section is called American Indian Responses to Environmental Challenges. It's an interactive online lesson that has rich video that the museum staff shot in Native communities. It's an examination of four case studies of Native American nations in the United States today who are dealing with specific environmental issues. Another section is called Living Maya Time, which is a whole website that teaches about Maya culture, both ancient and contemporary. It explores Mayan astronomy and measures the movement of the sun to predict the seasons and looks at the Mayan calendar system. It also looks at Mayan mathematics and the glyph systems. A resource site like this is so incredibly important today, especially in our current political climate. The NMAI is rewriting history in a way, so that our shared history becomes more accurate, and so that we Americans can come to grips, finally, with what our government and ancestors did to Native Americans. This country was built on Native lands and on the backs of slave labor, and our country has never really come to grips with that, and Native communities are still dealing with the effects. There are a lot of positive stories that come from Native America, and Native Knowledge 360 allows us to examine many of those stories, both the struggles and the successes of Native Americans. Check out Native Knowledge 360 at nmai.si.edu/NK360, or you can just Google Native Knowledge 360 and it'll come up when you have a few extra minutes. Native Knowledge 360 provides a pathway for us all to look more honestly at our shared history and contemporary reality.
Thanks for spending time with us inside 254. You can find us a lot of places online. On Facebook, we're at Inside 254 Podcast. On Twitter, we're at Inside 254 Pod. On Instagram, we are at Inside 254. And on WordPress, where we post links and places that you can go to donate or learn more about our activist actions, we're at Inside254site.wordpress.com. You can find our free episodes on iTunes, Podbean, Stitcher, TuneIn, Google Play Music, and you can also just Google us. There are two things you can do to help us build audience today. You can go onto Facebook, click one of those stars, and leave a comment as feedback, and then you can go to your listening platform and rate us on there as well. By doing those two things, that's going to get our word out and help us build our audience. Thank you for helping us grow.